You're listening to The Takeout.
This is your Tuesday Takeout Outtake Especial. And I'm Major Garrett, your host, joined as always by the political editor of CBS News, Steve Shigaris, the world's greatest podcast sidekick. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
We're joined by Joe Crowley, Democrat from New York, the House Democratic Caucus Chairman, the fourth elected leadership position within the House Democratic Caucus. And we're going to talk about pop culture, movies, music in a minute, but I also want to talk about 9/11, because there is a deeply personal aspect of 9/11 to our guest, Congressman Crowley. And before we get to that part of it, I want to play a soundbite from the congressman about our current president and that historic and horrifying event in American history.
But let me ask you something. Where was Donald Trump in the days and months and the years after 9/11? He didn't stand at the pile. He didn't lobby Congress for help. He didn't fight for the first responders. Nope. He cashed in.
Congressman Crowley, first responders. It is a topic near and dear to the heart of every New Yorker, but especially to you. Tell us why.
Well, my cousin John Moran was 42, was a battalion chief in the FDNY, and he was one of the first to respond to Tower 2, and he lost his life that day on 9/11. His brother, Mike, we're all kind of more like brothers than cousins, and my mom's sister was his mom, and we grew up together. I was 3 years younger than him. My cousin Mike was a year younger than I am. He's a fireman as well. They lost 12 men in his firehouse. He was off duty that day, or we would have lost Mike as well. And my little brother, Sean. So we're all kind of together. We all played music together. We taught each other how to play Irish music and Bruce Springsteen and the Beatles and everything. He was a great musician. He was a Fordham Law School grad. He was a great, great man. And we lost, 342 others just like that. We lost, thousands of people that day with individual lives that mattered. And I always think about John. I got a great picture of him in my office here in Washington. And I think of what we lost and how devastating it was to my family and, still is to Father Will.
You mentioned Irish music. The noises you hear around us, possibly. Kelly's Irish Times, a well-known watering hole and excellent restaurant near Capitol Hill. It is our host for the podcast this week, episode 10, and for your Takeout Outtake Especial. Congressman, I want to ask you, what point were you trying to drive at with that critique of Donald Trump and 9/11? And what, if anything, now that Donald Trump is the president of the United States, have you learned or divined about what he thinks about New York, security, the budgets there? Mm-hmm. His very existence as the 45th president of the United States puts a heavy burden on New York City.
There's a lot of dichotomies here, I think. One thing I was trying to portray and get across was that if anyone thought that Donald Trump felt he owed anything to the city, banish that thought from your mind. He was never really a father of the city, someone who looked out, I felt, for the interests of the city. As I said, I've had a 30-year career in elective office, and I've met him once. I don't really know him personally at all. So he was absent. He was absent when one of the most horrific events to our country ever happened, and in our city. He really was not around. And then when he was around, he was taking advantage of breaks, tax breaks, or funding from the federal government when he didn't need it. Others needed that to keep small mom and pop businesses going through those months when there was no one. It was a desert down in Lower Manhattan. And he took advantage of it because he could, and I think that was wrong.
Can I just ask, though, what you thought last year when, Ted Cruz criticized New York values? Do you remember this moment? Mm-hmm. And then Trump famously at that debate defended New York values by citing 9/11.
You had two 110-story buildings come crashing down. I saw them come down. Thousands of people killed. And the cleanup started the next day, and it was the most horrific cleanup probably in the history of doing this and in construction. I was down there, and I'd never seen anything like it. And the people in New York fought and fought and fought, and we saw more death and even the smell of death. Nobody understood it, and it was with us for months.
What went through your head when he did that?
Well, I was thinking, here's the hypocrisy here, that Look, I appreciate the fact that someone stuck up for New York during that time, but he was not the right guy to do it, in my opinion, because I don't think he's ever really had New York's back either. You know, so there's no question he's from New York. You can tell in his accent, the way in which he handles himself, I think, to a fairly well. But I don't think he's ever had the back of New York City, and that was demonstrated, I think, clearly. One of the only times I ever saw him was at the 15th anniversary of 9/11. I'd never seen him physically in my presence very often before that.
And how does it affect you, if it does at all? And I assume it does, but I don't want to be presumptuous about that. The question of terrorism, counterterrorism, how we posture ourselves, how we balance the equities of a free society against security. Having 9/11 be so close, not only geographically, but personally to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're always trying to balance these things out. My cousin John responded to the first attack on 9/11 back in 93. And one of the pictures he had sent back was a picture of him at one of the pillars. And he never thought they could ever take those buildings down. You know, he was wrong about that. And a lot of experts were wrong about, you know, what the possibility could be.
The 9/11 Commission called it a failure of imagination.
Yeah, the possibility of what could happen. And I think, we live in a time now where we're dealing with radicalization. We are dealing with folks who at all costs want to do harm and do it in personal ways, and not just against our military, but against us personally. That's something that we see what happened in Britain this week. We see what happened in other free countries that hold democracy and freedoms close to their chest. It's something we're going to have to continue grapple with back and forth. And the cost of that, you know, it's an enormous cost to the city of New York. And one of the things the president has done in his first budget is to, you know, really take a slash to the OWASI accounts, the Urban Area Security Initiative, which I helped put together after 9/11. We cut it by over $150 million to New York City alone. And that's not a way to address these issues.
And this runs on Tuesday. This is your Takeout Outtake Especial. The reference is to what happened in Britain last week. But the mayor of London said this is a reality of urban living in the 21st century. Do you believe wildcat, lone wolf terrorism is a reality of urban life in the Western world?
I think it has become more and more. We've seen what's happened in Belgium. We've seen what's happened in France. We see what's happened in Germany. We see what's happened in Great Britain and the United States. That these are things we have to prepare for. We need to be ready to respond to. I think being prepared is the most important thing we can do and respond. But look, if you want to live in a free society, if we really believe we're free, we have to make some sacrifices as well. And that is not belittling in any way, shape, or form the lives of anyone, because I think of that American tourist from Utah that died in London last week. You know, that could have been anyone, any one of us. It could have been my family, or in fact, it is our family. It's at what cost of our freedom? Those are the things we have to try to balance.
So this has been a heavy kind of segment for the Takeout Outtake Especial. That's the fault of your estimable host, Major Garrett. But I want to lighten it up just a little bit. We're at the Irish Times, Kelly's Irish Times, near Capitol Hill. And to get to a lighter segment, a more musically informed and enjoyable part of this segment, let's listen to a little bit of original music.
But of all the islands I have seen, I love my home best. And if ever I return again, there's one place I will go. Be to my feet, each of where the shadow.
Sounds like somebody we know.
Congressman, who is that balladeer?
Where did you get that from? Someone's getting fired. That was me with We Banjo 3 a couple of years ago in my office, I think. So that's an old Irish song. And the funny thing about it, it was number one in Ireland in 1965, in the summer of 65, during the height of the Beatles. And the words were written by a man named Fitzpatrick, who died as a cop, as an immigrant from Ireland, in 1947. And his grandnephew today is a member of Congress from Pennsylvania, a Republican member, Brian Fitzpatrick. He wrote the words to that song. It's one of my favorite all-time songs. It was originally written as a waltz, and I turned it down into a ballad. A little more yearning about where he came from, wanting to go back home.
So what do you play?
I play guitar. I play a little bit, a little banjo, guitar. I played the trumpet when I was in high school, and I applied all that musical theory to the guitar, and fairly good at it now.
When you think of great guitarists, who do you think of?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, like, you know, Jimmy Page.
Yes. Ding, ding, ding.
There's so many great guitar players. But I think of guitar not only in terms of the virtuosity of playing the guitar itself, but I really admire people who play and sing and can do the whole bit, you know.
Singer-songwriters.
Yeah, yeah, do it all.
So if you are on a long flight and you've got your iPod in front of you and you're getting ready for your jams, what are they?
Oh, man, it's so many. I have very eclectic taste. I played traditional Irish music when I was growing up. I played in an all-black funk rhythm and blues band called the Coast to Coast Band for 4 years. We made two records and went absolutely nowhere.
But I love those guys. But you made two records. That's two more than I've made.
And, you know, Springsteen, the Beatles, Tom Waits. One of my buddies is a guy named Willie Nile from Buffalo, New York, and I can't get enough of Willie Nile. He's a fantastic person and a great singer-songwriter.
If you haven't listened to it, ladies and gentlemen, Closing Time is one of the great albums of all time. Tom Waits, absolute ballad. It's just a remarkable album.
Now, his singing could leave...
Right, you know, you don't listen for the song.
I love
for
it.
For the voice. Yeah. You listen for the lyrics.
Yes,
and the
are.
Ache. And the ache. And the ache and closing time.
With
yeah.
Their arm around your sweetheart.
Yeah.
Your Oldsmobile, you know. It's great stuff.
As a New Yorker, let's just talk about films for a second. A lot of New York films we can talk about. I don't want to age you here on the show, but you were... you're born in the
when
60s.
When you age him, you're aging me.
You're born
me.
In the 60s. You came of age in the 70s.
1962, yeah. Same as your host.
Some pretty big New York films. And I'm not talking about Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Travolta, Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
And you knew I was going to drive this into the ditch. Was
of
that
course.
A, was that an influence for you? Were you into
what?
That?
I kind of missed age? The disco age, though. I think when I played in that funk fusion band, we either too late or too early. I don't know what we did. We kind of missed the mark. But I love the Bee Gees. I think they were great musicians, especially, you know, for the earlier stuff. I kind of missed that. That was 77, I think. And I was, you know, I was... And I lived in a bit of a cocoon, I think, in my family, kind of growing up and stuff. So
you weren't out at the disco.
Probably if I saw the movie back then, I wouldn't have understood half the things that were going on. You know, for me, my favorite all time New York movie is The Pope of Greenwich Village. I just think it's so quintessential Lower Manhattan and New Yorkish that it's to me. I can still watch that movie and never get tired of it.
Have you ever seen the movie City Hall?
I have.
With Al Pacino. What do you think of that movie?
It's okay. It's all right. I knew a lot of guys who were extras in it. They did it down in City Hall and friends of mine. It was all right. It was okay movie.
It's a decent urban politics movie.
Yeah,
not great.
Yeah. I guess, you know, living in and being a part of it, I can see the flaws in it kind of thing. Maybe overly critical of it.
Right.
So.
Too close to it always hurts.
Yeah.
When you think about great political movies, what do you think of?
Oh, gosh. You know, there aren't that many great political movies, quite frankly.
Because a lot of them get it wrong, right?
Yeah, but I guess, you know, All the President's Men, I think probably.
Which is less about politics and more about detection.
But, journalism.
It's a great detective movie.
It's also about politics, though, and how they kind of responded to it and how woefully and adequately they responded to it.
Let me ask you a question about House of Cards. I have a brief, very brief cameo at the last episode of season 2 of House of Cards.
Haven't gotten there yet.
Yes, you'll enjoy it when you see it. It'll flash by in an instant.
Major, fantastic.
Thank you, Mr. President. Here's my take on House of Cards, and I'd like to have your evaluation of it. Mark Meadows, Republican from North Carolina, was our guest in episode 9, and he said House of Cards gets it right. I'm not so sure House of Cards does get it right. I think what House of Cards does is reflects Hollywood values on Washington, because I think Hollywood values are much more bloodthirsty and blood-curdling and the ends justify the means,
right,
than politics. Now, politics has all those aspects, but I think Hollywood takes it to a different level. And my interpretation of House of Cards has always been, that's Hollywood laid over politics.
Well, my wife, Casey, she'll say things like, I wish Washington was that exciting. You know, this stuff doesn't, we don't really kill each other, you know, literally. But there were some parts of it I thought were pretty accurate. Sometimes when they were watching, I think, the education bill in the first year's episodes, that really didn't play out the way which it would have really played out on the floor. But they try to get, I think, you know, the realization of making TV and kind of squishing everything in, how difficult it is to really get the message or the real flavor across. But they did a pretty good job, I think.
I think it's similar to when we watch movies about journalism, right?
Right.
Very, very few people get it right. Anchorman. Anchorman was pretty. But I think Broadcast News might have been the only one to really nail it, right?
No. Broadcast News is terrific. But as anyone who's watched my Twitter feed knows, at Major CBS,
I'm sorry.
Network.
Yes.
Network is the greatest movie ever made. Why is Network the greatest movie ever made? Not only is it a movie about journalism, not only is it a movie about power, not only is it a movie about culture, but it is a movie that absolutely predicted the future. Many movies aspire to that. Only one movie actually has. The world of Network...
Back to the Future wasn't so...
is the one we actually have come to live in the past decade or so. At least that's my opinion, Carnes. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I actually think Cadillac Man is one of the best movies out of New York as well, so we didn't go there. Look, I think it's an ever-changing nature of politics and ever-changing nature of media. And what we're doing today is it's a combination of old and new, so to speak. So it's
absolutely.
Adapting, you're adapting to it. We're adapting to the political climate of our time as well. It's kind of fresh and new.
And when you're adapting to the political climate, how much does social media affect, influence, or drive what you're trying to accomplish?
More and more. I think that's one place where the Republicans have had an advantage on us, where Democrats have to catch up, and we're catching up, but it's quite a task.
Why would you guys be behind
I know.
On that?
I'm like,
what
why,
are you talking about?
Why did we lose the Midwest? You know, so I don't know, because we got to figure it out. You know, we got to figure these things out.
That's the voice of Joe Crowley. You have been listening to the special Tuesday outtake. Wait a minute. Let me start that again. The special Tuesday takeout outtake especial. Joe Crowley has been our guest, congressman from New York, Queens, and the Bronx. Steve Shigaris, the political editor of CBS News, has been my ever valuable, world's greatest podcast sidekick. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Major.
You know where to find us. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. Rate us, subscribe to us, talk about us, and tell every one of your friends about this America's fastest growing political news podcast, The Takeout. This has been your Tuesday Takeout Outtake Especial.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Nick Feynman, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.